Session number 8735.
Dr. Saxton, tape 5.
Yes, well, our first efforts, my first efforts at transfusion in the Harama battle then, were facilitated by having stored blood delivered by Dr. Norman Methuen from the Madrid Blood Transfusion Institute, which he'd started.
Was that very difficult, because, you know, bearing in mind the battle that was ongoing, was it very difficult to get it sent to you, to transport?
No, I mean, he brought it, I didn't know how, I mean, he brought in a van by, the road was still open. So, I don't know what difficulties he had, he just arrived with this van and that's all. He only came two or three times, but he did bring me, on the second occasion, I suppose, instruments to help me to get my own blood, let's say, from local donors, which in fact came down to the staff. It wasn't all that easy because the staff were working all out anyway, and one didn't feel we could take a great deal of blood out of them, but we did. And so gradually we built up some local donors, and then he gave me, as a start, a two-way syringe by which I could give arm-to-arm transfusions. It sounds difficult, it didn't. It was a very nice French syringe called a Joubert syringe. And if you pull out the plunger, the piston in the syringe, with it twisted in one position, it sucked in the fluid, or blood in this case, from that one side, and it twisted it over and pushed the syringe back, and it pushed the fluid or blood out from another side. So it was a two-way syringe, drawing in in one way and twisting over, pushing out the other way through two separate exits or entries. And this is called a Joubert syringe, and I used the Joubert syringe quite a lot then and thereafter. But that was after his second visit. So until then, I was doing this tube and funnel delivery of blood from the stored blood which he provided. The battle went on for several weeks. And it was really a sort of, one became almost an automaton, you know. You were just going on and keeping on, keeping on, and that was it. And the patients would come in, the wounded would come in, we were doing what we could for them. Many were dying, and a few were surviving and were sent on, or even some of them wanted to go back and did go back, who were not badly wounded. But it seemed to go on for weeks and weeks, and one got the impression it would never end, you know, the feeling I expect. When a thing gets into that state, you just go on and on. We stepped on when we could, again, mattresses on the floor mostly, and some of the odd rooms were not being used. We grabbed food when we could get it. We even had short breaks when we could go and get a little fresh air when the rush wasn't too wild and others were coping. But generally speaking, it was a hard slog all the time.
Did you have any contact with the inhabitants? You know, would there have still been villagers about?
Oh, yes, there were villagers about, and they did come and help and offered help and helped to clean and clear up things and bring in food. Oh, yes, we had contact with the villagers and the mayor, who kindly provided us with the accommodation.
So presumably they were pro-republic, the local people.
Well, yes. Of course, wherever you are in a war situation, and the people who are antagonistic to you, if there are such people, you see, not much in evidence, they keep out of the way. So that, although I am sure in mind that the vast majority of the people there were on our side, on the Republican side. If they hadn't been, what would they do about it, you know? Because, after all, we were part of an army, and we wouldn't stand much sabotage and like that without taking stern measures. And we would expect and want and expect then all the help they could give us.
Regarding the blood, were you carefully matching blood groups at that time?
Oh yes, oh yes.
And you had facilities for that?
I knew my basic four blood groups, and except insofar as we were, some of our blood that came as Group O, the sort of universal donor as we used to call it, which didn't need to be matched. Yes, it was matched.
And you had facilities, presumably, for doing
yes,
that?
Yes, I had a certain amount of grouping serum, which I used. Of course, I learned a lot as I went along, not hopefully by too many mistakes. I don't think I made any mismatching mistakes of a major type. Of course, nowadays there are subgroups, and even at that time we were beginning to realise there were two kinds of group twos. But because there were different ways of classifying blood too, and they had different names of sort of A and B and A, B and O. That was one kind. Although there was just 1, 2, 3, and 4, and you had to. Well, I knew which was which. I had in my student days. I'd got some quite firm ideas about blood groups. Fortunately.
Did you take manuals away with you? You know, when you packed up to go to Spain, did you think of taking medical books?
A few, nothing big. Yes, I think I had a book on surgeries, while I recollected, I took with me.
And did you use these?
A bit, not much. Not much, no. We had to just get on with the job. We hadn't much time for reference.
How important was it to have the blood at the right temperature?
Well, we did warm it up before we gave it, when it came out of the fridge. Nothing very accurate. I mean, tried to bring it up towards blood temperature, but no, it's not absolutely essential to have the exact temperature, but to put in ice-cold blood would certainly upset a person and make them freeze, but to put it in, say, between room temperature and blood temperature is good enough. It's the volume of fluid they need, you see. This is from there.
Yes, how many pints were you sort of putting into people, the bad cases?
Unless, I mean, the average bottle is rather less than one, is a pint, roughly. Same then as it is now, really, which is not very much in proportion to what the patient usually needs under these circumstances, which is probably 3 or 4 pints. And but they didn't get it. We couldn't afford that. We just had to give them what we could and hope it was enough for them to survive. The body has reserves of blood, of course, and can, to a limited quite considerable extent, make good severe losses of blood, but and survive with far less than the normal for quite a time.
Did you find it necessary to select patients to give transfusion to? You know, was the shortage such that you were having to do that all the time?
Oh, yes, certainly. Not only because of the shortage of blood, but the shortage of time. I mean, it takes a certain amount of time to put up a transfusion with the primitive equipment that I had. And then if there's nobody else to sort of keep an eye on the transfusion, I mean, eventually I had assistants and I got nurses to help and laboratory workers we got later on and so on. Things developed very considerably later on. So that is how I started in blood transfusion with the Jarama battle. I was that petered out in the end with fits and starts, and eventually we had a bit of a rest and went on to other scenes of activity.
What was the outcome of that battle?
Well, the outcome again was a sort of fixed front by which I think a portion of the Valencia-Madrid road was in fact unusable because it was too near the enemy. I'm not sure they actually took the road, but they probably dominated it in some way with artillery or something, so that it wasn't usable. And so there had to be a bypass of that portion, but the traffic went on quite adequately, so that the object of the battle, from our point of view, had been successful in preventing Madrid being cut off from its vital supplies from Valencia, so that it was successful in that respect, and the front was stabilised at that point.
Were there many air attacks during that battle?
There were planes, yes, and a lot of our casualties were caused by attacks from the air, but of course there was also every other weapon that was available at the time. There were tanks, and there was artillery, and machine guns, and all the rest of it. With a lot of very severe casualties, and of course it was very difficult getting the casualties back over the terrain that was there, and many came back in a pretty poor state, and many never got back, of course. Yes.
Are there any particular days you can remember, you know, when things were bad, that stick in your mind? Or people?
Actually, no, it seemed to be one sort of long struggle to just keep on keeping on, and I can't in a way fix on any particular day after we once got going, except perhaps that happy arrival of blood with Dr. Bethune from the Madrid Blood Transfusion Institute. Later, when the thing died down, I went to the institute to see what they were doing and learn some more about transfusion.
Yes, I must ask you about that.
After the Battle of Jarama, and even unto the present day, there are reunions of the people who survived from this, the veterans. And in the 15th International Brigade was included a battalion of the Lincoln Battalion of volunteers from the United States of America, and they have produced a record of the song called Jarama, which we all sing, the British too, when we meet once a year in the ever-diminishing numbers of veterans of the Spanish Civil War. And this is the song.
There's a band in Spain called Jarama. It's a place that we all know so well. It was there that we gave out our manhood, where so many of our brave comrades fell. We are proud of the Lincoln Battalion and the fight for that it made. There we fall like true sons of the people, as part of the 15th Brigade. There's a Yarrow so well. It was there that we gave up our manhood, where so many of our brave comrades fell.
Treated in this particular hospital, yes, were many of them from the International Brigade?
Yes, it was, as I think I did say, quite a mixed crowd there. There were about half and half Spanish and International Brigaders, the patients came in. The International Brigades, as time went on, got more and more diluted with Spaniards. Into the brigades were introduced Spanish battalions and companies and so on, so it got more and more, it retained the same name, but it was more and more sort of Spanish. But at this stage, the brigades were fairly much the majority of people of one nationality or similar language-based groups, such as the Franco-Belgians. And nevertheless, of course, we got soldiers wherever they were. They came to us. We didn't discriminate. We just took whoever came and did what we could. But they were, I would have said, about equal numbers of Spaniards and other nationalities coming in from the Jarama battle. Well, we went on from there to numerous other battle scenes. I think Brunetti was the next one that comes to mind. I think it was Brunetti. Now, this was later on when there was an effort to relieve the pressure on the other side of Madrid. But my knowledge of the geography and the so on is not good, nor the chronology of the war. I was concerned, as it were, with the actual medical side. So sometime during this stage, sometime a good bit after Jarama, then I think I had a 6 weeks leave. I went home and I went to Paris. I think, yes, at the time it wouldn't it. There was an international exhibition in Paris and I visited that and I went home also to collect equipment and I got all sorts of useful things to enlarge my blood transfusion capabilities, and through the Spanish Medical Aid Committee in London. So I got some more of these Joubert syringes, which I'd got to like so much, so that I could always have a spare one or two sterile ready for use. I also got a very ingenious, simple, but ingenious. So many simple things are ingenious, or vice versa. Sort of simple kind of pump, which would pump blood in at a given rate by just turning a handle. And what it did, in fact, was a roller which squeezed a tube. And each time you squeezed it round in one circle, it squeezed along a cubic centimetre of blood. So it was supposed to do anyway. And this was for direct transfusion. So you could just pump the blood out of one person into the next, just turning a handle. And, of course, it had a nice little meter dial on it so that you could see how many times you turned the handle and therefore, in theory at least, how much blood you'd pumped in. It was very ingenious, very simple to work, and I love this instrument. And
where did you get the funds to buy these things?
Well, the Spanish Medical Aid Committee raised a lot of money. They had tremendous meetings throughout the country. They got donations from trade unions and I suppose some from political parties, I'm not sure about that. But trade unions and meetings, the Spanish, they had fantastic meetings. Now, another person has just died. And yeah, we're all dying. Can't remember the name of him. Anyway, we used to have these. I wasn't there, but I mean, the Spanish Med Aid Committee organized enormous meetings throughout the country, drawing vast numbers of people, and collecting money at these meetings in very considerable sums. Thousands and thousands of pounds were given, which were spent on sending ambulances, on sending medical equipment, on buying expensive instruments, and drugs. So that, you know, we were reasonably well looked after in that respect by gifts of money in this, mainly in this country. And as the same, I mean, we were British men to get it, but there were people from France and Belgium, other countries, many other countries had fundraising events and supported medical assistance in various ways. So that it's going on certainly in the European countries and then in the Canada and the United States. And as I said at the beginning, our collections were made very considerably in the Soviet Union. So in some parts of Europe, where it was possible, it wasn't possible to raise money in Germany or Italy, owing to the nature of their governments for this sort of purpose, but wherever it was possible, money was being raised.
You said you went home on leave. Mm. Was this normal, you know, in the International Brigade, that you did have this leave period whereby you could get back to Britain?
Well, I think not everyone could do this. I mean, the battle seemed to rage so continuously for the people who were fighting. The Harama battle kept sort of starting and stopping again, and you never quite knew when it was going to end. And you go out for a rest, and after 24 hours, they were back in the lines. So that there were great difficulties in getting any proper leave. And I think we were a bit privileged because we had a dual allegiance, you might say, both to the army and to the Spanish Medical Aid Committee. And so with that sort of influence, we had a bit more facility for getting leave. Nevertheless, it wasn't all that easy. And you couldn't say in the middle of height of the battle, say, I'd like to go on leave now, please. They say, well, you must still wait till things are a bit easier, you know. So that it had to be selected according to time and who could look after the work that you were doing and that sort of thing. So not everyone could get on leave. And maybe I was more fortunate than some. I had 6 weeks leave in Iraq. I came home. And I went back, as I say, with some nice equipment which I accumulated and selected and asked for and got. And so then I think the next battle I was concerned with, I missed one while I was on leave. I think it was Belchite, I think. I missed that battle. But I was back for the Brunetti offensive. Now there we were sent to a hospital in a monastery. It was established in a monastery. Now, oh dear. This is a very well-known place, which is the where all the monarchs of Spain are buried. Oh, where the devil was that? Well, at any rate, it was there, and beside this, what was then turned into a museum, which is where all these monarchs were buried, and where, in fact, I went and observed all their various, I don't know, their mausoleum, whatever it is, in a sort of basement. In the same village, there was the monastery, and close to the place where the burials had taken place, and we had this hospital there. Well, there again, there was a whole mass of wounded coming in a terrible rush, but I was better prepared by this time, and I had grouped all the staff and anyone else I could lay hands on, and I was able to take blood as and when, more or less, as and when required. A lot of it was used as taken. A lot of it was stored blood. I was still getting stored blood from Madrid, and I wasn't taking any for storage myself. So I either had stored blood from Madrid or direct blood taken on the spot and given arm to arm with the new syringes I'd acquired. It was again the same sort of thing. I was working a lot in triage and sending patients on to the surgeons. It was there that Julian Bell came in. He was quite a well-known family, a well-known person himself. He'd been in China, I think, doing a teaching job, actually. And he came out to us as an ambulance driver.
Did you meet him?
Yes.
What was he like?
Only too well, poor chap. I met him when he was wounded. I think I'd met him before as well. It was, of course, the one particularly comes to mind is when he was brought in severely wounded. He was a very nice man, very nice man. Of course, he was a sort of liberal-minded person, like a number of others who came. They weren't so politically committed. They felt they had to show that they too, it wasn't only communists who were concerned, they had to go and do it to show that there were others concerned as well, you know, because after all, the vast majority, well, 50% at any rate, of all the volunteers who went to Spain would have been communists, were communists. And he wasn't. But he came and he did his best, and he drove his ambulance up close to the front and picked up wounded and brought him back to the hospital. But his ambulance was attacked from the air. And, he could see he was going to be attacked. He stopped the ambulance and, for protection, crawled underneath it. It was empty at the time. He was going up to the front. And, unfortunately, a portion of bomb came horizontally along the ground and hit him in the chest. It must have hit him. It hit him through a wallet. So, quite probably went right through there into his lungs, taking a bit of the wallet and its contents right into his lungs. He was in a pretty poor shape when I saw him, and I transfused him and prepared him for the surgeon, a man whom I still know, a Spaniard, a Catalanian, a very nice guy by the name of Brogi. We hadn't got facilities that are necessary for operating on a lung because of the air pressure. You can't open up a chest wall, which lets air in, and the patient go on breathing. If you open one side sufficiently and you haven't got forced breathing, then the whole thing sort of shifts over under the air pressure, and the other lung can't work, and it interferes with the action of the heart. In fact, it's not feasible. So all Brogi could do was really to clean off the surface and to pick out bits and pieces that wouldn't actually open up the air breathing parts. And he took out bits of the wallet and other pieces that were accessible from the surface and closed.